Okay, I would like to welcome all of you to this special presentation on the deep national security state and UFOs. And this is going to be a presentation 4 hours in length. We will take a break at about the halfway point, maybe about an hour and 45 minutes in, 2 hours. And I'd like to just thank all of you for coming. I know you've been from all over the country here, people here from Chicago, New York, all over, and I want to express my appreciation for your support and effort in coming all that way to be here. I'd also like to welcome all the folks online. There are several thousand people online who will be seeing this by webinar, and I'd like to extend a welcome to them and a big shout out to them for coming. Thank you. You're here in virtual reality, huh? Yeah, why not? So I'm Dr. Stephen Greer, and the founder of the Disclosure Project and the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence and the Orion Project. Those are all now sort of amalgamated under SiriusDisclosure.com if you want to go and see what all the projects are doing at any time. And we're going to be doing this presentation, which is going to be part of a series. I really want to thank the people who've supported me all these years in getting this far. There's some folks who are volunteers out front who've been on many expeditions with me out under the stars, and people all over the world. My mentors in the national security state, who without them I would have never had a Sherpa to figure out how this whole system works. You're going to learn things tonight, today, that the President of the United States doesn't know. I will assure you of that. I will give you my assurance that it's true. It is also true that without some very special person, and her name is Emily, my wife of 36 years, we wouldn't be here. So a big thank you to Emily. She set this up. And really and truly, if Emily had not supported me all these years, there aren't many Jewish doctors, daughters, wives, who will be happy with their husband leaving a career in emergency medicine to be doing this for virtually nothing for 25 years. And that's when we started this project 25 years ago. So she's an amazing person, and without her, we would have never, ever gotten this far. She's really been the indispensable person that nobody knows about. I want to acknowledge her. So thank you, Emily. Love you. So the other thing I'd like to do, as we just some housekeeping things, again, no cell phones, please. And if there are any children who are on the webinar, I know this sounds strange. We're going to go through some things that are disturbing, and I would say parental discretion is advised for that reason. I usually would not say that, but we are today, and I need to say it. And the first thing I want to go through is sort of an architecture of what the deep national security state is. Because this is something that when I started out in 1990, I didn't think could possibly be true. And in fact, when I was meeting with the French government officials a few years ago here in Washington and then out at our farm in Virginia, I got a phone call from an Air Force intelligence guy and a liaison to the French president at that time, Nicolas Sarkozy, who said, "This is fantastic and terrible." And he didn't know if he quite believed it. And I said, "Well, come to Washington and I'll let you meet with some folks who are in the deep national security state who will confirm everything I'm about to tell you." So they came to Washington. And we had a meeting. And I began to explain to them that there are two governments. There's the government of we the people, Thomas Jefferson spoke of, that we have elected, and those who have been appointed. And since World War II, there has evolved a monster, which we're going to hear about, which desperately needs to be put on a leash and eventually phased out. And that is the deep national security state of unacknowledged special access projects. Now, this is a term most people are not familiar with. Almost most of you, if you're anyone here from D.C., raise your hand if you're a D.C. person. You probably have heard of TSSCI, Top Secret Special Compartmented Intelligence. A top secret clearance are like 985,000 people who have them. It's you know, that and $1.50 will get you on the metro. So those are not unusual. What's unusual are the projects I'm about to talk to you about. And these unacknowledged special access projects are projects that have not been supervised by the president or the Congress in an appropriate way since 1956, at least 1956. And this is a key date for you to keep in mind. I was 1 year old, so I couldn't do anything about that. Most of us here weren't of an age where we could have done anything about that disaster. But we're going to talk about how that evolved and how an unacknowledged special access project really operates. The very first thing you need to understand is that it developed as a consequence of the extraordinary secrecy around the UFO issue. And if you doubt it, it goes all the way back to 1945. And I'm going to go through some documents. The one that's up here is one that we acquired and released. It's now the number one viewed document on the FBI site, this one. But before I get to that, I want to talk about what happened in the 1940s, in World War II. So most of you know we had President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and there were events going on in Europe and also in the Pacific, but mainly in Europe, where there were these things called Foo Fighters. Yes, it's a rock group. And Dave Grohl, it's a great guy, he named his band after what I'm about to tell you. But a Foo Fighter, aside from being a really fun rock band, were objects that were flying around our aircraft in World War II. Sometimes they were fully materialized, hard. Most of the time, they were an energy field that looked spherical. And they could come through an aircraft, even coming down the center of an aircraft and out the other end. This is the trans-dimensional nature of extraterrestrial technologies that I covered in a previous workshop. This became a huge concern for the Allies. And the Allies dispatched, or the president, I should say, on behalf of the Allies, dispatched a man named General Jimmy Doolittle. Now, how do I know this? Because his nephew is a dear friend of mine, Dr. John Altshuler. Dr. Altshuler is a hematologist, oncologist in Denver, very renowned. And he was asked, General Doolittle was asked to go over to the theater of operations in Europe to find out what the hell these things were. Now, the word Foo Fighters come from sort of French and German faux for fire, because they were these fiery, had a luminous corona around them. And but they would disrupt electromagnetic signals. They would have effects on the gravity around an aircraft and other things such as the guidance systems, compasses, and what have you. And so we thought, the Americans and British thought, it was a secret Nazi weapon. And we found out through our spies that the Germans thought it was a secret Allied weapon. And, of course, it was neither. So General Doolittle went over and investigated this and came back to the White House and reported back to President Roosevelt and said, "Sir, these are interplanetary vehicles," I'm quoting. And so began the modern era of a serious concern from the national security level about UFOs. You can argue it went back to the airship scare of late 1890s, where there were massive crafts seen off the coast of California, but there wasn't that much official concern at that point. It was sort of an enigma. But in World War II, because of the type of weapons being developed, both by Hitler and by America, the interstellars, as I call them, became very concerned about what humans were doing on Earth and the risk of us destroying this planet, which I believe, in carefully in analyzing the history of this, that they have a interest in its survival and humanity's survival. And so the president at that point did assemble a group of folks that included Oppenheimer, people who worked on the Manhattan Project, Dr. Vannevar Bush, no relationship to President Bush, and others to look into the issue. By the time we detonated the first atomic bomb, the facilities at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico and Alamogordo, that area, were being overflown regularly by UFOs. And they were very concerned, obviously, that we were developing weapons that could terminate life on the planet. And they could see where this was headed. So this was not something that just happened out of the blue. There's a history here you must understand. In the early days, and I'm talking now from the early mid-1940s until 1956, there was a reasonable level of constitutional oversight by key members of Congress, senior people in the administrations, and the President of the United States. Everything changed in 1956. Now, when we had the only nuclear, and actually technically it's an atomic bomb squadron and not a thermonuclear one, that was developed later. Everybody know the difference between atomic and thermonuclear? Atomic bomb is fission, nuclear is fusion, hydrogen. Anyway, the atomic bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was developed, as you all know, in New Mexico, and was tested at White Sands, and eventually in Roswell, New Mexico, that was the only bomber squadron that had atomic bombs in the world for a number of years before the Soviet Union developed them. And in 1947, there were two or three, I have intelligence recently that indicates there were three so-called flying saucers, discs, flying by and doing surveillance of the 509th Bomber Squadron, which was the only atomic bomb squadron in the world. And they switched on, suddenly, an alleged radar system. Read this document carefully. Now, this, I know it's hard for you to see the original. It's dated 1950. It was to J. Edgar Hoover. The Edgar Hoover building's right near here. And an Air Force source stated that there were three flying saucers recovered in New Mexico. They're described as circular in shape with raised centers, 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape, but only 3 feet tall. They're actually about 39 inches tall. In metallic cloth, very fine texture, etc. And it says that the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it's believed the radar interferes with the controlling mechanism of the saucers. This is a little bit anthropocentric and childish, because if you can go interstellar, you can handle a radar system. What actually happened is that those radar domes had a scalar longitudinal electromagnetic weapon, which is another whole classification of electromagnetic warfare systems that we'll get into later. But suffice it to say, it was an early scalar Star Wars hit. And when they switched that on, at least two of these discs collided. One went down northwest of Roswell. The other one continued and was more intact and was impacted near Socorro, New Mexico. And that's where they actually retrieved the bodies. The ones that was just north of Roswell was obliterated into little teeny pieces, tiny little pieces. Where they did retrieve, and we have Disclosure Project witnesses who have testified to this, who have personally seen what looks like almost hieroglyphic writing on some of the little parts that were retrieved. And I know I've seen these, and it's very interesting because it's reminiscent of the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, but not quite the same. Makes you wonder where the pyramids came from. So that event was an early hit. Now, there are some reports of others, but that's the most documented one. This document from the FBI is significant because, obviously, 3 years later, you had one branch of the government trying to find out what the other top secret branch of the government was doing. You can tell by the tone of it. I made inquiries through here and there. So it's a bunch of skullduggery that happens between agencies and competition. And there's always been competition between FBI, CIA, Air Force Intelligence, et cetera, and so on. And this happens not just with the United States. It also happens between allies and alliances. For example, the next document, if you can pull this up, this is one of the most important documents. And by the way, after I briefed the CIA director about all this stuff, the sitting CIA director for President Clinton, which we'll get into in a moment, I got a cache of several thousand of these documents, about 5,000 of them. And they're in my vault. I don't know what to do with them. If we presented what was in them, it would take us from now until 2017. But let me just say that this document was accidentally released by the Canadian government, and if you look at the date on it, 1950, November 21st. How ironic. This is the 65th anniversary of the writing of this document by Wilbur Smith, who had a top secret clearance, and he was tasked by the Canadian government to find out what the Americans were doing. And if you look at page 2, if you go down to page 2 of this, you're going to see just a brief summary, which I think is, there's a whole lot of detail in the document. This is on our website now. You can look it up. Many of you may have seen this one already, but the reason I want to present it is the importance of the document. And it says, the matter is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher than the H-bomb. Think about that. The H-bomb wasn't detonated until 1952. It was the ultimate doomsday weapon. This project dealing with UFOs and interstellar technologies was more highly classified than the H-bomb. Period. B. Flying saucers exist. Period. Their modus operandi is unknown, but a concentrated effort is being made by a small group of headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who also worked with Edward Teller, Oppenheimer, and others. And 4, the entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. I have a whole dossier that a Canadian put together of the Wilbur Smith investigations on behalf of the Canadian government to find out what in the hell the Americans were doing with these extraterrestrial vehicles. It's a fascinating case. Now, the reason this is so important is that it acknowledges several things, that they exist, that it's the most secret issue in the U.S. government, exceeding the secrecy of the H-bomb, and that a group had been put together to study how they operate. Well, they were studying materiel recovered from one or more interstellar crashes that were the result of using these scalar longitudinal electromagnetic systems, which Tesla had worked on and others had worked on in the early part of the 20th century. Keep in mind that by the early 1900s, there had been experiments done on not only scalar and electromagnetics, that longitudinal systems, which are, just to put it in a simple layman's term, the light in this room that we're looking at, it has a wave function and a particle function. It goes 186,000 miles a second. A scalar longitudinal system is, there's no wave. It's boom, and it's a point, and it's multiples of the speed of light. And so once you understand how these operate, and I have folks at the Naval Research Labs here in Washington who have done communication systems developed based on pulsed scalar systems that are multiple of the speed of light. So if you think that you cannot communicate faster than the speed of light, you are wrong. And the physicists are wrong. It's because they don't know about the scalar end of this, but that's enough because that's all classified. They're not going to teach you that at MIT or Caltech. So these systems have been developed and have been deployed since at least the mid-1940s, which is a frightening thought because it's an area of technology that is potentially devastating if it's in the wrong hands. And unfortunately, it fell into the wrong hands, and there it remains. So one of the things that happened along the lines around this time, the next document, a very important one. Look at the release date. It was a little while after, a few months after I briefed the CIA director. So after I met with him, I said, look, I'm going to give you a list of stuff I want to see if I can get. I got this massive box. Came out to my farm in Virginia. And this is one of them, and there are others. And it's from 1953, although you can't see the date on it very well here. It's written by the director of the CIA to the director of Psychological Strategy Board. Psychological Strategy Board? What? Psychological warfare. And it says, you can read it, I'm transmitting to the National Security Council a proposal, tab BA, which we don't have, which is concluded that the problems connected to UFOs appear to have implications for psychological warfare as well as for intelligence and operations. And then there's another tab, B, which has the background. I'd love to see that one. I suggest that we discuss in an early board meeting the possible offensive or defensive utilization of these phenomena for psychological warfare purposes. Remember this document 4 hours from now. Because basically what they concluded was they needed to do a few things. They wanted to be able to set up a deception around the subject and put out false information, use it as a cover story for classified aerospace research. So oftentimes there will be something that happens and it will look like a UFO, and it's actually a Northrop Grumman. My uncle's company was Northrop Grumman. He worked on the thing that landed on the moon, the lunar module. Or Lockheed Martin Skunk Works or some other aerospace entity, and it will be 100% man-made, and the public will say, oh my God, it's a UFO. And they'll not correct them. There's no correction forthcoming. They want you to believe it's a UFO. Why? Because it provides a cover for classified research with technologies that, if they were allowed to come out, would terminate the oil and gas and coal industry. They're using zero-point energy and gravity control. Which then brings me to the next issue. And that is, by 1954, October, so now we're 61 years plus 1 month, into an era, and this was confirmed to me by the third highest ranking official at the Naval Research Labs and the highest ranking scientist, in other words, someone who wasn't a bureaucrat, at the Naval Research Labs, which Thomas Edison founded, and the Naval Research Labs is the largest defense lab in the United States. And Richard Foch, and I knew him for many years before he passed away of prostate cancer not too long ago, was this gentleman. I've never wanted to discuss who he was until he passed away. And he was a very senior guy in this system. And one of the things that he shared is that he was in the vault, the same vault that the next document came out of, which has a great story behind it. And he was going through some documentation and found that it wasn't in the 50s that we really started, I mean the 60s or 70s, but it was in the 50s that we actually mastered gravity control. Now what does that mean? Gravity control is the ability to put an electromagnetic field at certain voltages and with certain angular momentum. I don't want to get into a lot of, I'll put you to sleep, I'll get into the physics of it too far. So that this object becomes massless, weightless, no mass, M-A-S-S. So the mass component, and this has to do with angular momentum and things of this sort, of the subatomic particles, can make this object so light that it has no mass, which means if you look at your physics equations, mass, velocity is inversely proportional to mass. Go look it up. So if mass becomes zero, velocity can go to infinity in a given amount of energy, which means you can move into another dimension. It doesn't go to infinity. You go trans-dimensional. We'll talk about this some more later. And this began to be experimented with in the 1920s. A guy named T. Townsend Brown developed a system using crystalline structures and very high voltages going into an object so that an object would begin to levitate. Marcel Vogel, one of the chief engineer scientists for IBM in North Carolina on the Reynolds estate, did the same thing in the 60s and 70s. One of the members of my team and one of our disclosure project witnesses worked with Marcel Vogel doing this with crystalline structures. And it can be crystals, but it can also be nanocrystalline materials such as metallic. So, as you know, most metals and rocks are crystal. Actually, water is crystalline. We're crystalline. So you can put this system around almost anything, and it will begin to become increasingly massless. Now, it doesn't have to be zero mass. Maybe it's 0.1 mass. So it's still materialized, and you see it. But it means, man, can you accelerate this thing? So it means you can, instead of going like the space shuttle at 25,000 miles an hour, you can go at several million miles per hour and take a right turn. And there's no deceleration effect because everyone on board is corrected for 1G. So this is what they began, 1G gravitational force. So this is what began to develop in the 20s, got taken into some Army Air Force projects in the 30s and 40s, and was Adolf Hitler's secret weapon. Adolf Hitler, they weren't making the progress on the atomic bomb that we were, but they had almost perfected gravity control by the time World War II ended. Now, one of the things that the OSS did, the Office of the Special Services, which became the CIA after World War II, they had something, you can look this up, called Operation Paperclip. And Operation Paperclip, a whole book was written on it not too long ago, about how they would put a paperclip on the file of the Nazis that we didn't want to go to Nuremberg and execute, but that whose knowledge was so great that we wanted them as part of our program. We wanted what they knew. So one of these guys is a guy named Wernher von Braun, who, of course, invented the rocket, the V-2 rocket for Adolf Hitler. Hermann Oberth. These were all the giants of rocketry and aerospace for Adolf Hitler. They became the foundation of, brought in by the CIA, what became the CIA, of our space program in the 1940s and 50s, which is how we leapt ahead of the Soviet Union, because we took all those people first, ahead of the Soviet Union. Interesting bit of history. You don't read this many places. But a lot of what I'm telling you is in conventional history books, not the UFO part. That's been sanitized out. That's forbidden knowledge. So as a result, by the time we had those guys and the experimentation that had been done by T. Townsend Brown, whose work became a part of a corporation called the RAND Corporation, which still exists, a huge think tank, we really had something going. You add to this the study of materiel and electronics retrieved from interstellar vehicles that were shot down. So a lot of people say, oh, well, the things we have, are they all just reverse engineered from interstellar ET? I said, no. The laws of the universe are universal. And the mind of man, just like the man of an ET, can unravel the mysteries of the universe. And so it has come to pass. But if you take, we're not starting at zero when we retrieve the objects that were interstellar. We were starting with decades of research in classified electronics, electromagnetic fields, anti-gravity, scalar systems, et cetera, and so on, that had been going on since the time of Nikola Tesla, the true genius of the 20th century, not Albert Einstein, by the way, so who is a minor luminary compared to Tesla. And Sorry, Einstein fans. It's true. By the way, that's why when Nikola Tesla died, the FBI swooped into his apartment and confiscated all of his secret papers. And how do I know this? I have a document from the Department of Defense demanding that the FBI turn them over and names them for what they are, the secret papers of Nikola Tesla. This is not an urban myth. I have that document. It came in this cache of documents I'm talking about. So when you have all of that knowledge, it's then augmented, increased, potentiated by the study of, as the Wilbur Smith document says, the materiel that was interstellar. Because you need specialized materials. You need control systems. You need integrated circuits, which we did not have in the 40s, which came from this. You need fiber optics. You need all kinds of stuff. So some of the technologies, and this is where Colonel Corso, who worked on these projects tangentially, is correct. If you read The Day After Roswell, he says fiber optics, integrated circuits, and a whole slew of things came from studying the materiel from these crashed ET interstellar objects. So you had the biggest and most top secret, most well-funded project in the history of the United States going on. Nobody knew about it. It's completely sub rosa. It was more secret than the hydrogen bomb. And so between 1945 and 1954, the brain power of those Nazi aerospace folks like Wernher von Braun and Herbert Oberth, the work of T. Townsend Brown and others, Edward Teller, some of the brightest and most ingenious people in the world, bent their attention primarily not to the hydrogen bomb, but to gravity control. And how are these interstellar visitors getting here? Because that would then be the ultimate edge, wouldn't it, in the technological arms race. You talk about a delivery system. You don't need an intercontinental ballistic missile that goes a few thousand miles an hour if you can deliver something instantly from one continent to another, or worse, from one planet to another. You begin to see the implications of this for national security. Therefore, it was managed in an extraordinary fashion. And the secrecy around it was increasingly ruthless. So much so that by 1956, the President of the United States, a man named Dwight Eisenhower, most of us drive on Eisenhower-era highways using 1880s Mercedes-type internal combustion engine cars that are run by fossil fuels, all of which have been obsolete since the 1940s or sooner. But Eisenhower was a five-star general, became president, two-term president, and was a Republican, very patriotic, but also very naively trusting. Jackie Gleason, the very famous comedian, his wife, were friends with some folks that had been on my team before they passed away, and said that Eisenhower on his deathbed was a very bitter man over what happened to him between 1954 and when he left office in early 1961 when Jack Kennedy became the President of the United States. And in 1956, a man named Nelson Rockefeller, who later, of course, became Vice President, and prior to that was an operative in the military-industrial complex and the emerging deep national security state, Nelson headed up what's called the Rockefeller Commission. And the Rockefeller Commission in 1956 reorganized the Pentagon, Department of Defense, CIA, the whole alphabet soup of secret entities. And they did so in such a way that it became labyrinthine, Byzantine, almost impossible to penetrate by anyone who wanted to navigate through it. In the early days, there was still some presidential knowledge. We have one of our witnesses, Mr. Lubkin, who is an attorney, who was a young man, White House Signal Corps here at the White House down the street from where we're speaking today. You can look at his testimony on our website, seriousdisclosure.com, and he said, yes, he would be at meetings and Eisenhower would be making doodles, pictures of UFOs and ET crap. In fact, I have one sitting in my condo here in D.C. that someone lifted from the archives, I won't say where and how, and he said basically Eisenhower was voiced to him great frustration over the fact that there were all these projects going on and he had lost control of the oversight of them. So what happened with the Rockefeller Commission in 1956 is that they made it virtually impossible for any ordinary congressman or president, because, you know, they come every 4 to 8 years, don't they? So by the time they leave, even if they're there 8 years, maybe they're a little less wet behind the ears. But it's a system that guarantees their ignorance, except to the extent that they want to give you just enough information to control what's going on. We'll get into this in a moment. So by the time Eisenhower left office, he made the very famous speech about beware the military-industrial complex, as you've seen in the film Sirius. By the way, Sirius became number one on Netflix a few months ago. Cool. Thank you guys for supporting that. And the president said it will become a threat to our national security and our way of life. Not the UFOs, the secrecy. No less a figure the same year, Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, who was the first director of the CIA. Go look this document up. I mean, I have more documents than we have time for me to go through. And it's a letter where he's writing and saying that the secrecy around the UFO subject is a threat to our national security and to the United States. This is the first CIA director, because he also later found out he was being schmick-canned, pushed aside by these neo-fascists who had taken over the intelligence community, the aerospace community, and the large corporations. What happened over those years from 1947 until 1956 was that there was a deliberate, albeit imperceptible initially, takeover by the corporate state. Corporations working with unacknowledged special access projects, which are completely off the radar, not funded officially, took over operations. And as a result of that, those national security programs increasingly became out of reach for the president, out of reach for members of Congress, or even cabinet-level people like CIA directors and secretaries of state and secretaries of state and people of this sort. So this was a gradual thing that happened, but there was an abrupt change by 56. By 1961, when Eisenhower left office, frankly, we were done. It was done. Now, you know, I couldn't do anything about that at that point. Couldn't run the disclosure project because I was only 5 years old or six. And so it just suffered and went along. And the national security apparatus got bigger and bigger and bigger. When Jack Kennedy took over in January of 1961, he had a great interest in this. And he was, in fact, briefed on the subject. But as we know from Lieutenant Halt, who was on the early meetings I had that, ironically, Nelson's brother Lawrence Rockefeller, who is the white hat in the Rockefeller clan, who actually wanted to end secrecy on the subject. Lawrence Rockefeller was a very early supporter of CSETI and the Disclosure Project, and he funded and I organized the Asilomar Monterey gathering of KGB, CIA, astronauts, cosmonauts in 1995. And what I found is that some of the people who came had been involved with the Kennedy administration. And one of these gentlemen, this lieutenant colonel, was on Air Force One flying to Berlin when Kennedy made that very famous speech, "I am a Berliner," although I think he misspoke it a little, but from what I hear from the Germans. But on that flight, this Air Force officer, who was sort of like the chief steward who sort of ran Air Force One for the president, had a chat, and this issue came up because he had been a pilot who had seen one of these UFOs as an Air Force pilot, and there are thousands of sightings like this that we have in our archive. And he brought this up to the president. He says, "Oh yes, I know about this." He says, "I've been briefed on it a little bit, but," and now I'm quoting, I have this audio tape, it is chilling, the audio tape. But he says, "Unfortunately, the whole matter," this is the president speaking, "the whole matter is out of my hands, and I don't know why," and began to cry. So we know, and that was 1963, June of 63, and of course he was killed in November. But before that, some other tragic things happened. There are a lot of tragedies here, the main thing being the loss of almost a century of evolution by the human race, which is why I left medicine. I always tell people, I used to say try to save a life one at a time. Now we have to do something to save the entire human race and planet from what is a disastrous situation that's developed. So I just say that now all of us have to work together because our patient is Gaia, the Earth, and her 7 billion children. But if you look at this document, the next one, this is a very dangerous document to have. I'm going to have to give you the provenance of this. This is the Marilyn Monroe document. It's basically a death warrant for poor Marilyn Monroe. And you look at the date on it, 3 August 1962. They found her dead the 5th of August. It's signed by James Jesus Angleton III at the bottom. Project Moondust up at the top, and Project 46. These are correct code names and code numbers for UFO ET-related projects by the agency as of that date. And as you read through it, and it gives some background, it's a wiretap summary if you look at the top of it. I know it's a very degraded document, but it's a wiretap summary of telephone conversations between Marilyn Monroe and Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, and a guy named Rothberg, who was an art dealer in New York. And they were tapping Marilyn's phone because she had had tryst, as it says here, with the president. And everyone knows now she had an affair with both Jack Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And in pillow talk, the president had told her some things. And it says one such secret that she was going to divulge in a news conference mentions the visit by the president at a secret airbase for the purpose of inspecting things from outer space. I don't think they're talking about meteorites. Kilgallen, who had been a reporter who dug into this, replied that she knew what might be the source of the visit. In the mid-50s, Kilgallen learned of a secret effort by U.S. and U.K. governments to identify the origins of crashed spacecraft and dead bodies from a British government official. That was Lord Mountbatten. Kilgallen believed the story, who was later blown up by an IRA bomb, or so it was made to appear. Kilgallen believed the story may have come from the New Mexico crash in the late 40s, clear reference to the Roswell event. And she said that if the story is true, it would cause terrible embarrassment to Jack and his plans to have NASA put men on the moon, because we were using old rockets from the 40s. When the secret organization already had anti-gravity under control. The subject repeatedly called the Attorney General and complained about the way she was being ignored by the president. The subject threatened to hold a press conference and would tell all, underline in the original document. That's not my underlining. The subject made references to bases in Cuba and knew of the president's plan to kill Castro. And number five, the subject made references to her diary of secrets and what the newspapers would do with such disclosures. 2 days later, she's found dead. Now, this document, how did I get it? It's top secret, and it has not been declassified, and it is authentic. A man whose family helped found the National Security Agency, NSA, was so supportive of what the work I was doing that he appeared one day with this document. And it was a huge, one of those old Xerox from a big, government Xerox machine. The original I have in my vault is quite impressive. And he says, you need to know the kinds of things. I think he was not trying to scare me off, but he was wanting me to know the kinds of things that have been done to people who tell these kind of secrets. And so he gave me this document. And as soon as I saw it, I suspected it was legitimate. Later, I had it inspected by a man who I don't wish to name, but he was the officer who was General Odom, O-D-O-M, who was head of the NSA for years. He was General Odom's right-hand guy, literally carried his briefcase. And he became a document authenticator and a lecturer at University of Maryland who, frankly, when he looked at it, he says, without me taking it from the vault myself, I can tell you 95% certainty it's authentic because everything in it. So basically what happened is that Marilyn Monroe was being jilted by the Kennedys because it was becoming too well known they were having an affair. The Kennedys did not order her assassination. Angleton did. Now, who is Angleton? Angleton was the big, whole books have been written about this guy. James Jesus Angleton III was the guy who at the CIA was the big mole hunter. He was the guy who would chase down anywhere a leak was coming from and had everyone tapped. And he realized that she was about to light this up and hold a press conference to talk about the ET bodies from outer space and all these secrets that Jack Kennedy had told her just out of spite. She was just furious that they had sort of pushed her out of the inner circle. And, you know, the whole thing about a woman scorned. But unfortunately for Marilyn, it cost her life. I later, after I got this document, met with a man who at that time had worked in the intelligence unit of the Los Angeles Police Department who separately had a wiretap on her in her home, who confirmed to me this was 100% true. Now, I don't know how many of you know a guy named Burl Ives, who's a actor and singer, and everyone thinks he was like Frosty the Snowman, but he was actually a very accomplished actor and folk singer and very good friends with Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor, people like that. And he was on my executive committee for a number of years, and by the time he was involved, I had that document. And I went to visit him. They had moved from Montecito in Santa Barbara up to Anacortes, Washington. And I was in his room. I was actually sitting on the edge of his bed. He was up there in years. Big, jolly guy. Great bear of a guy. And I shared this document with him. He says, oh, my God. He's a 33rd degree Mason, by the way. He says, we all know, every one of us knew Marilyn had been killed. But we never knew why. We had no idea why. This is why. This is the thing. And so that was also a shot across the bow to the Kennedys. Now, Jack Kennedy had great affection for Marilyn, even though it was indiscreet for him to continue seeing her. And he was furious that someone in the intelligence community, I don't even think he certainly didn't know about this document. He was very upset, is what I understand, that Marilyn was killed by these operatives. And he vowed to try to bring out this information himself. And I think that's why he began to speak a little more openly to this Air Force officer whose audio recording I have. And that was, of course, a year later. This happened in August of 62. The recording with the Air Force officer, that conversation with Jack Kennedy happened in 1963, June. In November, he was assassinated. As Kennedy was planning, if he had become the president, he was going to dissolve the CIA, get us out of Vietnam, disclose this information, and make peace with the Soviet Union. That's what he was going to do. And those folks in the intelligence community and the warmongers and the profiteers and the military-industrial complex said, like bloody hell you will. And that was the end of him. So that's why, I mean, although I thought they were joking initially, when I first... Is this getting... Is this good information for you folks? I hope it's not too much, but I'm going to cover an enormous amount today. You've got to know the background. So over this time period from 1945, 40s to 19 early 60s, there developed a decision was made. I know this sounds like a joke because everyone says it. If I tell you, I have to kill you. But there's some truth to that. So the secrecy that got developed around this issue became more and more and more restricted, even from people who were presidents or Senate Intelligence Committee members or members of the cabinet. Because another man who was killed, John Foster Dulles, shoved out of a window. Dulles was killed. He had been CIA director. He was starting to make noises about changing the direction of things, and he was also killed. Dulles Airport's named after him. So the decision was made, how do we do this without risking having to continue to engage in the wet works? And there's a guy I know at the CIA who kind of has my back, who has been there for years, PhD guy, who has a team of wet works guys. Wet works are assassinations. So wet works are wet comes from blood. So, you know, you don't want to pull the trigger on wet works if you don't have to. So they've decided here in the 50s and 60s to create so much secrecy and have it so compartmentalized and tightly held that they didn't want to risk doing that anymore, because it was really disruptive to the nation. And that is really the genesis of unacknowledged special access projects. Now, a special access project just means you have to have the clearance to get to it and be read into it, as they say in military speak. But an unacknowledged project, I just want to go through a minute how that works. Let's say that this gentleman is a four-star general, and I'm a colonel. I made you a four-star general. But I'm in an unacknowledged special access project dealing with this or some other subject. It can be other things as well. If I am in an unacknowledged project, I am told, and I have one of my most senior military advisors has been in multiple of these. He was in one project that was $2 to $3 billion. He knew it was more than two and almost $3 billion in a project that was off the books, no accounting, president didn't know, Congress didn't know, tightly held, a military guy working with some corporate folks. And he told me, he says, here's how it works. He says, they take you to a SCIF, a Secure Communication Intelligence Facility, SCIF. Take all the equipment off of you, any guns off, cell phones, watches, nothing, anything metallic. You go into this underground facility, and there's a meeting. And he said, you have a come into Jesus talk. And what happens is that you are told that only the people in that room are read into and cleared to this unacknowledged special access project. And if you speak of it outside of that circle of people, there's one person there with a gun and a bullet. He takes the bullet out and he says, it has your name on it. If you speak to anyone, and I mean anyone, your wife, the president, your commander, about what we're doing. And that is how it works. This is not a conspiracy theory. I've been in these SCIFs. I've been in a couple places. And I can tell you that is exactly how it operates. So one of the things I wanted to make really clear about what I'm presenting today, I'm not talking about anything that I don't have firsthand direct knowledge of. Everything I'm telling you. Every bit of it. But I don't care about conspiracy theories. They're mostly 99% wrong. And I really don't care about the internet chatter. You know, this is 25 years of the most incredible investigative research. And, you know, I put over $10 million of my earnings and life into doing to get this far. And I can tell you, if you're in an unacknowledged project, and I was offered this position back in 92, and asked my wife about it, and I rejected it. I was actually offered $2 billion personally, if a fund with $2 billion in it, if I would shut the hell up, join one of these unacknowledged projects, and do what they wanted me to do. And I said, screw you. I'm not doing it. But that's what was offered. And that's when $1 billion was a lot of money back then. Now, you know, they're minting a billionaire every week in Silicon Valley. But, you know, in 1992, $2 billion was a lot of money. So what ended up happening in this scenario is that if my four-star commanding general calls me in because he's heard rumblings about something that people are working on he didn't know about, under threat of death, TWEEP, terminate with extreme prejudice, which is death, TWEP, I am to turn to him, even though he's my four-star commanding, I'm only a colonel, and I'm to say, sir, no such project exists. That's how it works. It's illegal, it's unconstitutional, it's criminal, it's dangerous. Because once you have a breakdown in the rule of law, we're back in the jungle. We're back into Al-Qaeda territory. We're back into the Wild West where there's a lawlessness. And that's what happened. And because of that, no president since Eisenhower has had anything near the level of information on this that would be required for the chief executive. Most CIA directors haven't. There are a few who have and a few who haven't. And I'll tell you a little bit about why that's the case in a moment. Who's been in and who's out? Dick Helms was in. Woolsey was out. It's a long story. But, I mean, I'll try to cover it. I mean, you guys are going to get more information. It's going to be TMI, too much information by the end of this. But this is why I'm doing this today, is that I want to leave a record of everything I've learned that's critical for the public in case, you know, I'm 60 now. So who knows what will happen to me? So it's important to leave this. But if you're the president, don't assume that you have an all-access pass. The presidential daily briefing doesn't have anything really that critical in it, and almost never this subject. By the time you had Johnson come around, and then you had Nixon, and Nixon, by the way, was vice president for Eisenhower. Nixon actually was pulled in as head of the Space Committee. The vice president sits as chair of the Space Committee into Majestic. This group, MAGIC, M-A-J-I-C is actually what it's called. It's a majority intelligence committee, M-A-J-I-C, it's the proper term. And MAGIC tapped Nixon, and he thought as president, he would be the guy that would disclose this. Because he thought it was time, and he was finally became president after Jack Kennedy, he felt, swindled him out of the presidency in 1960. And then, of course, Lyndon Johnson inherited the presidency in a sense after the assassination, had one term, part of another, the rest of Jack Kennedy's term. But Nixon thought, well, okay, I'm going to do this. And so a little thing called Watergate happened. Everybody remember Watergate? Those of you too young to remember, it was the break-in over here at this office in a luxury apartment on the Potomac. And it was a bag job. Bag men went in and broke into the Democratic National Committee offices to get lists and information, and Nixon ended up covering it up. I mean, it's kind of standard operating procedure. You know, it's like it wasn't really that big of a deal in the sense that it happens all the day, you just don't know it. But there was a guy named Woodard who was ONI, Office of Naval, you know, Bernstein, Woodard and Bernstein. Look it up. And Office of Naval Intelligence is where he came from. And suddenly this young reporter has this deep throat. Well, he had an ONI guy give him the information, Office of Naval Intelligence, because Nixon was planning to blow the lid off the secrecy. And the way they took him down was by impeachment rather than by a bullet. That's actually why Nixon was impeached. Now, he did do the Watergate, and he was a crook. But, I mean, I would say most politicians have engaged in such things. I know I'm a bit cynical about it, but, you know, it's not that unusual for dirty tricks and oppo research to be done against someone else, and you have someone go and steal something or rifle through trash to get dirt on someone, and that's what they were doing. And in this case, it was a break-in, so technically it was illegal, and then he covered it up and he got impeached. But the real reason why that became such a big scandal and hit the shit hit the fan was that this ONI guy, Woodard, had a source that he worked who had the actionable intelligence on what really happened, and there goes the president. And of course, you know, we had Ford, who was a part-term, time guy, and he had a CIA director, Bill Colby, who was a member of MAGIC. Bill Colby, I'm giving you like a 50-year history real quick.